This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Welcome to the America Change Forever podcast. I'm Jeff Pegues. This week, we're taking a look at the economy and the global supply crisis. It's beginning to look like this supply chain bottleneck is going to have an impact on the holiday season. Here's the problem in a nutshell. Right now, there is this massive congestion in ports. So the ships with the goods that we all want can't dock, and then once they make it to shore, there aren't enough truck drivers or workers to unload. Dr. Patrick Penfield is a professor of supply chain management at Syracuse University. Why do you think people should care about this global supply crisis?
Well, the reason why they should care is just because there'll be a lack of products and prices increasing.
How would you explain what is happening?
Well, it's actually a combination of things. So the first thing is COVID-19, which has really kind of created this demand pattern change. So because people were cooped up at home, they decided to buy products. And so demand increased. Then we've had weather events such as flooding, tornadoes, hurricanes, which has really impacted production and facilities. We've had cyber attacks, ransomware on some large production facilities. And then lastly, we've continued to see labor shortages. So there just aren't enough people to fill all the vacant jobs that are out there.
How long has this been developing?
So this really started to take off when the pandemic hit. And then that's when we noticed the demand pattern change. And then from there, it's just been increasing. And so unfortunately, we are a global supply chain. So when there's one disruption, we can feel it here as consumers.
How are businesses having to adjust?
Well, the primary way that they're having to adjust is increasing prices. So that's why, it just seems that everybody within the channel is passing along that price increase. In addition to that, they're having to pay higher wages, to be able to attract more workers to come to their place of business.
Patrick, do you think this will persist?
Yeah, this issue probably will persist into 2022, I'd say at least the third quarter. That's if everything else is fine and there's no issues with another COVID variant. I wish I had a crystal ball, but again, the variables, that's the dilemma that we see. So, right now the supply chain is very fragile. So it just takes one thing to knock it off kilter and then, it impacts all of us.
Is this unprecedented?
Absolutely. This is what we would term a black swan event. So nothing we've ever seen or prepared for. And so a lot of lessons to be learned from this particular situation.
So what do you think the lessons are?
Well, I think you kind of have to look at your supply base and really kind of understand where you're getting product from, how you're getting that product, and then try to build in some redundancy, try to build some alternatives, and really try to be more proactive as far as making sure that you have enough product to meet your needs.
Is China playing a role in this too?
Yeah, absolutely. China is playing a role. So I think it's gotten worse because they're kind of under an energy crunch right now. So because they have a lack of energy, they're unable to produce as much as they produced in the past. China has also seen unprecedented demand. So there's just a lot of demand that's being placed on China. And unfortunately, with the energy crunch that they're in right now, they've really cut back as far as what they've been producing.
The biggest bottlenecks are at what ports in particular?
So that'd be the Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Long Beach. So about two-thirds of freight actually goes through those two ports.
California's governor signed an executive order to alleviate congestion. That happened this past week. Do you think public officials should have planned better?
Yeah, I've seen the governor of California trying to get involved. Obviously, President Biden has tried to get involved. I think there's some opportunities there. It's just, somebody's got to kind of take control and make some things happen. So I'd say specifically about maybe moving some of those ships to the Port of Oakland and having the folks at the Port of Oakland actually unload some ships. So they actually have capacity. So I'm surprised that, you know, these moves aren't being made yet. I think there's things that really are out of their control. So as government, we believe that we can influence things or try to control and make things better. But there's only so much that government officials can do, especially in the world of the corporation. So I think there probably were a couple of things they probably could have done better, you know, if they've got involved earlier. But I think, you know, now we're in a crisis mode. Now everybody's trying to, you know, again, trying to intercede and trying to make things better. So I think some of it's happening. Could they have started sooner? Absolutely.
You mentioned that there are a couple of things that maybe they could have done better. So what do you think those couple of things are?
Well, I think first is again, utilizing the Port of Oakland. If they have capacity and they're close by, why wouldn't you use them as a port? The second thing is, you know, trying to get more trucks in there, right? So from what I understand, there's a time from 3 a.m. to 8 a.m. where the terminals aren't open at the ports. So why can't we open up the terminals so that way the trucks can get in there and get what they need? So, you know, the terminals are owned by private owners. So for them, it may be an impact to their profits. And that may be why, you know, that they're not open from 3 to 8 a.m. in the morning, which, again, just boggles my mind why they aren't open.
When businesses pass the cost of some of these interruptions on to the consumers, is that something that happens temporarily or is that something that is baked in for the future?
Yeah, it will be baked in for the near future. I mean, you've got stuff like commodities that could, you know, go up and down, like steel and lumber. Yeah, but for consumer goods, once you got a price in there, you know, for the most part, usually that's baked in and then you'll continue to see price increases.
Dr. Patrick Penfield, thank you.
You're very welcome. You have a great day.
Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst for CBS News, and she writes the nationally syndicated column Jill on Money. All right, Jill, tell me about this thing you call the gray rhino.
It's my new favorite thing to talk about. I know. It is so cool. Okay. Here's what I came in touch with this term a while back, maybe like 5 years ago, when I'd heard about it as it was sort of weird. It like sort of made the rounds of like international economists. Why? Because the Chinese premier, Xi Jinping, started talking about gray rhinos. What is a gray rhino, you ask? It is a metaphor for a highly probable, high impact, yet neglected threat. So it's not a random surprise. It's not like, oh my God, a pandemic. Who could have thought about it? It is something that has a series of warnings and there's visible evidence of it. So, you know, climate change, for example, that could be like a gray rhino. It's with us. It could be a busy intersection with no traffic light until, you know, there's a horrible accident, then everyone pays attention to it. And the way I'm thinking about it is around childcare, because childcare has been an issue for decades. It is so expensive for families to pay for childcare, and they are struggling. And so this idea of childcare as a gray rhino kind of came to the fore for me as I was starting to dig into the Biden Build Back Better plan and try to understand the components that impact childcare.
How is that impacting the economy?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So I think in two major ways. First of all, it is hitting family finances in a very significant way. And you know, obviously, childcare issues have been important for a long time. But amid the pandemic, we had a lot of people who were home, a lot of frontline workers who needed care for their children who were under the age of 5, and even the school age kids who were home and were struggling to find the help they needed. Now, as we come through the pandemic recovery in the economy, there is something really strange going on in the labor market, and we've heard about labor shortages, but it looks like the labor shortages are most acute among women. And a lot of the female-facing fields, so the restaurants, the servers, the folks who are actually working in retail, those women seem to be leaving the labor force in droves. About 3 million women have left the labor force over the last 20 months, And the number one reason given is childcare issues. I can't find anyone to take care of my kids, or it's too expensive, or I'll stay home with my kids. I'm living in a multi-generational household, or I have a partner, and so I'm going to choose to do that. On the other end of the spectrum, there's a shortage of childcare workers who are predominantly women, but a lot of those women left the field because as childcare centers closed and everyone was on lockdown, they had to find alternative work. And it was kind of easy to find an alternative because childcare workers only make about $12.25 an hour. And as a result, they could find other jobs making a lot more money pretty easily. So on two ends of this spectrum, the supply of workers is drastically smaller, and the number of women leaving the workforce is really under pressure because of the high cost of childcare.
So what happens next in this economy to address some of these hiring shortfalls we're seeing everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few different aspects of this. You know, when we look at labor shortages, there is sort of the fundamental issue that there is a group of people who say, I don't want to go back to my low-paying job with no benefits and inconsistent hours. So that's one big group of people. And a lot of those people, especially if they have childcare issues, may have said, I'm going to stay home with my kids till I figure out what I want to do next. There's another group of people who are just fried. They are burnt out. They are frontline workers. They were in harm's way through a lot of the pandemic. Many of those people are retiring early or literally saying, I can't go back into that hospital setting. I can't go back into that school. I need to do something different. I don't know what it is, but I'm not going to just take a job in the same industry. And there's a whole other group of people who are like, hey, you know what? I have a side hustle now. I was doing something during the pandemic that I love, and I figured out how to make money doing it. And you put all these groups together, and you've got what is now a real labor shortage in certain sectors of the economy. And I have to be honest with you, it's not going to resolve itself anytime soon. This is a long-term trend. And for the first time in about 20 years, we are seeing workers in the United States have more power than their employers.
But is it having an impact on the unemployment rate?
Yeah. I mean, this everything has an impact on the labor market and the overall economy. So with the way that the government measures the labor market is two different surveys go out every month, right? The first survey goes out to the employers. Hey, how many people did you hire or fire or lay off this month? The other report goes to households. And they say to a household, they say, hey, Jeff, are you employed? Yes or no? And if you're not employed, are you actively seeking work? Yes or no? If you say that you are not actively seeking work, you are no longer considered part of the labor force. And so what happens is sometimes the unemployment rate can actually drop down, not because so many people got new jobs, but because a whole bunch of people left the labor force. And it just so happens that in this recession, in this COVID recession, that more women have left the labor force than men. In the Great Recession, the one in 2008-2009, it was flipped. They called it a man session, and this one they're calling a she session.
All right, so I checked. The unemployment rate is at 4.8%. At least that's what it was in September. Historically, that's a pretty good number, isn't it?
Well, listen, before we went into the pandemic, in February of 2020, the unemployment rate was at 3.5%. It went to an astounding, right, just below 15% over the course of a few months. We have worked our way back. We are not all the way there. But I think there is something more significant going on in both the economy and in the labor market. And again, I think this is really important to underscore that it has been a long time since workers have felt like they could go to their bosses and say, I want a raise. And they want to raise because prices are higher. We've had this very strange inflationary period right now where prices are higher above the board. But this is the first time when prices have gone up where workers feel like they can go to their bosses and say, I need more money. And if the boss says, I can't give it to you, that a worker now has options. So I think that there is something really seismic going on in the labor force because we haven't seen that in a long time. And I also have to be clear that we've never gone through anything like this. You know, one economist said to me, it's as if each of us went on a 19-month meditation about our lives, about the fragility of our health, about what is important to us and our families, about what we do every day for work and what we want. And the repercussions of what we learned over those 19 months is now being felt in the labor market. And it's dislocated in many areas. It does not mean it's going to be this way forever, but I also think it is naive of a lot of mature businesses to think that business will go back to the way it was pre-pandemic. It just will take some time. I don't think that's what's happening. I think there is something much more significant going on.
What should people do to take advantage of this economy?
Well, what I say is, you know, I am sort of go back to my roots. So I'm a math head, and I will come out of the closet and say, I am a math head. Please accept me. And I'm also a certified financial planner. And so what I would say is it's a great time to take stock of what motivates you, what makes you feel good, but also to take stock of your finances. If you are lucky enough over the last couple of years to have been fully employed, you probably save more money than you're used to saving because there wasn't so many places to spend. And if you're really trying to figure out what you want to do next, I think you have to start with, where do I stand financially? Can I afford to take some time? Is it possible that I could make a change in my life where I could actually do something that makes me happier? And can I afford that just on an ongoing basis? Can I also afford to do something like, hey, you know what? I'm going to sell my house. House prices are up dramatically. And I'm going to go move to a cheaper part of the country or move to a smaller dwelling because that will free me up to do something really exciting and fun. But without that knowledge of where you stand in your financial life, I think it's hard to make those decisions.
How are the markets reacting to all these changes in the workforce?
Well, I think that the markets are not the economy. The economy is not the market. We say that all the time. It's also clear that anyone who's lucky enough to be an investor over the last couple of years has been richly rewarded. Last year, U.S. stocks were up about 16%. So far this year, they're up over 19% as measured by the S&P 500. The markets have been very, the investment markets, the financial markets have been very good. I would certainly look at the gains that people have made over this last few years and say to yourself, okay, this is how much I made, but I know markets can turn against me. What is it that I need to earn in terms of a rate of return? How much risk do I want to take if I'm going to do something different, or am I on track to hit the goals that I already set out? And maybe I don't want to do anything different. Maybe all I want to do is shave a couple of years off of my work life. Maybe instead of retiring at 67, 64 is better for me. And I can run the numbers and actually see that it could make some sense. Be careful that you don't fall in love with the risky stuff in your portfolio because it can turn against you. And you know, anyone who has followed the last, 19 months in markets knows that, you could see the market make new highs in the middle of February of 2020 and drop by a third by March 23rd. And that happened. And you should pay attention to the fact that markets can swing like that. And so none of us should forget those bad times. We shouldn't count on the fact that you're going to have really buoyant, upwardly leaning markets forever. That's just not the way it works. Sometimes they'll go up, sometimes they'll go down. Over time, if you stay invested, you should do just fine. And you really have to just make sure you're not taking on too much risk at any given time.
Jill, thank you. Dr. Julian Malvo is an economist, author, and the dean of the College of Ethnic Studies at Cal State LA. Dr. Malvo, how do you see this economic recovery unfolding?
I would say that it's basically uneven. If you look at the macro data, it would look like we had recovered. Economic growth is certainly back to where it was. The unemployment rate at 4.8% is higher than it was a year and a half ago, but it's still low, relatively low. But we have some challenges. One is the issue of inflation, which is affecting the population unevenly. And the second is certainly the unevenness in the way that people are returning to work. so that people who have college degrees have pretty much recovered. They're back at work. They're making the same money, maybe a little more money in some cases. On the other hand, people who are not college educated and are those who work in the services have not seen their economic status rebound. So it's an uneven recovery that looks great if you're 35,000 feet and up. If you're 2,000 feet, not so good, especially when you look at places like Los Angeles, where the homelessness is absurd, and where, again, the homeless data speak to the unevenness of recovery. There are 40,000, at least, homeless people in LA. Black folks represent less than 10% of the population, but 40% of the homeless.
Not to be cynical, but it seems like economic recoveries are always uneven in terms of who benefits. How do you make this recovery more equitable? Do you need government regulation to make that happen?
Well, when you combine the unevenness of the recovery with the extreme unevenness of COVID, it becomes a much more dire situation. You're absolutely right. Nothing ever happens evenly in our capitalist economy. Those who are better off always do better on a downturn and in an upturn. But what we saw was a pandemic that hit hard, hit many harder than others, and those who had hit hardest are having the hardest time coming back. So no, we're not the unevenness is not unusual, but the combination of the unevenness of COVID and the unevenness of recovery leave a lot of people worse off than they were before COVID hit. But I think we need at least some government intervention. I mean, you say regulation, a lot of people get their backs up, you know, we're nanny economy, defining what people can do. That's not quite what needs to happen. What needs to happen is that government can move things around. As an example, we've got the supply chain backup, really just a log jam. Oakland, California has offered to help Long Beach and LA in their ports. Those two cities, as of this talking, have not taken up the offer. Government can move some of that by encouraging any number of ways those two cities who are backed up to accept the help of the Port of Oakland. Government can do some other things to facilitate the supply chain. I've heard President Biden talk about perhaps using military and others to help with the containers that are backed up in some of these ports. That could happen. I'm not suggesting that we pass a bunch of new laws because, first of all, there's resistance. Secondly, obviously, we can't even pass infrastructure. But what I am suggesting is that government often, in cases of strikes and slowdowns, uses its muscle to move things along. This might be a good time. We see empty grocery shelves. We see retailers concerned about Christmas, although why they're concerned about Christmas before trick-or-treat is a trick to me, but they are concerned about whether or not they have stuff on their shelves. So government can make it easier.
Can't help but noticing these days that there are a lot of jobs out there. We see a lot of signs. Why aren't Americans taking advantage of those opportunities?
Well, if you look at the labor market and you look at the so-called set of labor shortages, here's the question you have to ask. What are these jobs paying and what are the terms and conditions of work? In the last labor market report, more than 2 million women dropped out of the labor market, primarily because of childcare and related challenges, and uncertainty related challenges. In other words, if you don't know if school's gonna be open that day, what do you do? What do you do if you have small children and you have to make sure that they have care? Many women have dropped out of the labor market because of that. Men have too, let's be clear. Men are increasingly facing some of the challenges that women face, but what we're seeing is 15 an hour is $30,000 a year. People are acting like 15 an hour is a fortune. 30 grand a year when a family of four has a poverty line of about 27,000, well, that's okay, but it's not great. When you look at your major cities and what childcare costs, you're looking at $300 to $500 a week minimum. And if you're looking at $30,000 a year as a paycheck, someone's making a calculation, you know, maybe it's cheaper for me to stay home. even with the loss of unemployment benefits and other benefits, some workers are finding it more expeditious to stay home. Here's the other thing, Jeff. COVID allowed people to rethink the way they live their lives. So many people basically are like, I don't need the stress. I'll work less. I'll get paid less. Some people are saying things like, I'd rather take a job that pays less but has more benefits than to take a job that pays a lot and has no benefits. So you see basically us collectively doing this calculus about how work has changed because COVID changed what we think and what we value.
How is this economy impacting people differently, depending on whether you are an urban dweller or whether you live in the suburbs?
That's a really great question. I don't have data on it, but let's just speculate a little bit. We know that where you have agglomeration economies, where you've got lots of people, like in a city like a DC or in LA, there are more opportunities, not only in person, but also remotely. And what I'm finding on my campus, as an example, people have the luxury, if you will, or the opportunity to continue to work remotely if they have medical excuses through the end of the calendar year. This is true in a lot of other places. Amazon has said their workers will be working remotely through 2022. Now, who gets to work remotely? Certainly not the bus driver, not the person who cleans the airplane. I wrote a piece a couple weeks ago about getting off a plane and realizing the folks who cleaned the plane were on the plane before the people in coach had even gotten off. That's what kind of pressure they were under to turn the plane around. They don't get to work remotely. So the unevenness is to where you are. There are more opportunities in dense areas, but opportunities for who and what does that mean? Now, the flip side is that in rural areas, those who are well-educated and have access to the internet, which as we know is an issue in some rural areas, but if you have those two things, you can possibly work remotely. But if you don't, you really can't. So the uneducated, regardless of race, those who are not college grads or who don't have access to internet and other things, they're being left at the sidelines. The other piece of that, of course, in terms of inflation, is that depending on where you are physically, you're going to have less access to goods and services. So I would expect that you'd see more inflation in some rural areas. Inflation, after all, is just too much money chasing too few goods. That's it. You have more people who want stuff than stuff out there. And you can look at a number of examples to think about how this plays out. The automobile industry is a really good example. Cars are just more expensive. People don't have the sensors and all the parts they need, and so cars are more expensive. What do people do about that? Well, some people say, I'll just go without a car, or I'll drive my old car till it dies. Others trade differently. They may say, well, as opposed to getting a new car, I'll get a used car, which now both costs are going up as well. And it kind of depends on where you're situated on the continuum. Those who already have access are going to be able to make it happen, and those who don't are going to suffer.
Dr. Malvo, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Good to be with you.
That is it for this week's America Change Forever podcast. You can download previous episodes wherever you download your podcasts. Please subscribe, rate, and review. And don't forget to share the podcast. My thanks to Paul Woody Woodhull and District Productive. I'm Jeff Begays, and that is how America changed forever.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and host of the Money Watch podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It is a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and maybe more importantly, on your life. Follow Money Watch wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free on the Amazon Music or Wondery app.